Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Criterion Sessions, a special One Heat Minute Productions podcast where we dive into new releases from the Criterion Collection. We're talking about a March 27 release. And if you're a fan of Criterion already or you're a fan of Michael Mann, you know the release that I'm talking about. It's something that has been in the Criterion Collection. They're up to like 1,200 on their spine numbers. This is 691. It's been in the collection, but it has been revitalized and refreshed with a sensational 4K release. And that is Michael Mann's Thief. So who would I want to talk about Michael Mann to more than the other guy who is the greatest Michael Mann acolyte in the world? My dear friend and someone who just did the most outstanding interview with Michael, like very, very recently, mind you, which covers Thief in new ways that I don't think either of us, he interviewing and me reading, had ever heard Michael talk about Thief. It is the legendary Bilger Abeary. Bilger, so good to talk to you again, my friend.
Always a pleasure. So nice to be here.
The contemporary American auteur Michael Mann's bold artistic sensibility was already fully formed when he burst out of the gate with Thief, his debut feature. James Caan stars in one of his most riveting performances as a no-nonsense ex-con professional thief planning to leave the criminal world behind after one last score. But he discovers that escape is not as simple as he'd hoped. Finding hypnotic beauty in neon and rain-slicked streets, sparks and steel, Thief effortlessly established the moody stylishness, tactile approach and drama that would define such later iconic Mann films as Heat, The Insider, Ali, and Last of the Mohicans. It is so good to see you, number one. And number two, Thief, first and foremost, for those physical media heads out there, the release is very similar to the other release that you've received, except now we've got this absolutely gorgeous 4K rendering. And I want to talk to Bilger about the particulars of that, so we will get into it. But I have to say, you interviewed Michael Mann. Obviously, the headline people are thinking about Heat 2, what's happening, all those sorts of things. But the thing that like struck me, and particularly struck me on the rewatch of Thief, is the beautiful question that you asked him about this absolutely sensational centerpiece of the movie, which is a conversation between James Caan and Tuesday World in a coffee shop where they just give their whole lives to each other, their life stories, and the really deeply personal connection that Michael had with that himself, which I think is amazing. Can you share like what that was like talking to Michael about that and what you were thinking when he was talking to you about that experience?
Yeah, I'd never heard him mention the fact that this, I mean, with Michael, so much of this stuff, there's some kind of personal connection, right?
Of course.
It might not be a direct personal connection, but there's some kind of personal connection somewhere in the back that might not even seem, when first stated, like a personal connection. But he's a guy who just absorbs information. And, you know, a lot of filmmakers, I think, take the information they learn and then they just kind of regurgitate it. And Michael can do that. But I think the other thing he does is he absorbs the information and it kind of just filters through his being for years and years. And then it comes out in the most unlikely ways. But this one, you know, he mentioned that, you know, he had his then girlfriend, future wife, that he and his wife had once like had a conversation in that diner, restaurant, cafe, whatever, late into the night, 6 hours or something like that. And, you know, he talked about the way, and actually I don't have the interview in front of me, but I loved how he talked about the way the cars were passing by beneath them and how it felt like just like a bloodstream of lives just going back and forth and just, you know, commingling in all sorts of ways. And how moving that was to him. And it's funny because as he was talking about,
I can quote your piece.
Yes.
This long talk on Vulture is the quote is, I probably shouldn't even be answering this question, but he says there, he goes, That particular booth is a booth I sat in with the woman who became my wife. One time when I was driving her home, we stopped for a cup of coffee and sat there and talked for, I don't know, probably 6 hours. This coffee shop on a span over the tri-state tollway. I don't even know if it was a Fred Harvey's at the time. And something about the way the cars were constantly moving became visually analogous to a bloodstream. Life's moving through. People are going places. There's motion all the time. All these myriad of lives that are passing you by, coming towards you, going away from you, and you're in a span over it. And he's telling her in the most urgent way about his yearning he has, and off of it, he elects to make a mistake. He drops a coin and tells Leah he'll work for him at the end, which is an ironic twist.
And that's the thing that it was, what was at the time a little perplexing, but also very touching to me as he was saying that was, I don't know if he's talking about the scene in the movie or if he's talking about the way he felt when he was, right? And of course, it doesn't matter. It's both, right?
It's always both. It's never one with him.
And it's it's both in terms of he probably felt that way to some extent, but it also feeds into this kind of almost ongoing memory he has that is supplemented by the stories that he's told and the scenes that he's shot and things like that. Yeah, no, it was a very touching thing to hear. And the thing about Thief that it really struck me. I mean, I watched it a couple of times in the past, few weeks, both in preparation for this podcast and in preparation for that interview, is it isn't any one thing. Like, what I always tended to think of Thief as like one thing,
Yes.
and then you realize every time you watch it, it becomes another thing. Now, lots of movies we know, every time you watch it, you see something new. The thing about Thief that changes for me is, every time I see it, I think to myself, oh, this is a film about this. And then the next time I see it, I'm like, no, wait, this is a film about that. Like the actual, the very being of the film kind of changes every time I watch it. And some of that is obviously just all the things that Michael has put in it. And some of that is me changing over the years. But the other thing that Michael said that in that interview that I really kind of appreciated, and I don't know if he'd ever put it in these terms. This is actually the question where he says I shouldn't even be answering this question, right? Where I ask him, and it's like I feel like I must have asked him this before. I probably asked him this at some point, but I was like, why do you think your films are kind of resonating now? I mean, a lot of the films resonated over the years as well, but like over the past 15 years or so, both with people like you and me sort of helping drive the engine, but also the films are, it's not like we somehow pointed out, hey, by the way, guys, Thief is good, and suddenly everyone was like, oh my God, you're right. It's like the films are great,
The films
right?
are great. We're just cheering. We're just a consistent cheer in the background. That's what's happening.
Yeah, we're just reminding people, right? But the films are what it is. And anyone who comes upon the films is like, holy shit, this is actually fucking amazing. But the thing that he said that I thought was really interesting. He's like, I don't know why they resonate. I mean, he's like, it's probably a bunch of different things, but he's like, I put a lot into these movies.
Yeah.
I put a lot into these movies, and they're kind of different layers of meaning and layers of narrative, and they're just, he works so much into the films that you can't help but discover new things every time you see them. And that they can't, and so many different people find so many different things to love about the films, right? And I thought that was really touching because his thing, because then that brings me back to something like Ferrari, right? That he's been, which he worked on for so long, and there's so much in there. There is so much in there. And it doesn't immediately become evident the first time you see it. You can sense that. But like those films into which that much work has gone. And when I say work, that much research, that much preparation, that much emotional preparation, that much training and whatnot, all these things that have gone in there. I mean, this feeds into also the fact that, James Caan spent 6 months preparing for this part, right?
And even
When
the
that
beautiful, beautiful stories of like James Caan opens the safe, the first safe in the movie that he opens. they didn't tell him about the locked cabinet inside the safe. So he had to improvise how to open it because they were just messing with him at that point. He was so prepared to do this that they just put a locked cabinet and he had to figure it out. So he gets a hammer and a big, you know, a big pike and just bang, it smashes the lock out and then opens it up. Like it's...
Yeah. It's all these things feed into, with all these films, really, with all of his films, even the ones that didn't hit, all these films have this. There is this sense, you can tell when you watch a film that is greater than you in a way, like when you watch a film that is greater than what you're able to entirely consume in the two and a half hours of its existence, of that experience, you can tell, like this didn't happen. And this is true also of, you know, our man, Alan J. Pakula, you know, like there are filmmakers who do this. And I would say it's true of like a Catherine Bigelow too. Like there are filmmakers who do this. They pack so much into these movies. And when you watch it, you can tell. And sometimes the films might be a little messy as a result, right? There's a lot going on. And this
because,
is
because there's some conflicting feelings. It's like the layers aren't perfectly aligned to cascade. Yeah,
exactly. And those films very often stand apart from the types of films that have very easy, very sort of rational, let's say, and psychologically consistent narratives, right? I mean, another guy I think about is Spike Lee, right?
Yeah.
Spike Lee is the perfect example of this, so much so that sometimes he puts so much into the movies that the movies just like fall apart. But like he puts so much into these films, and there are inconsistencies within the films, right? There's like, wait, this guy was like this, and why is he doing this? And why is that character doing this? And why is this character, you know, kind of here and not there? And then you watch the movie again, and it's like, I get it. Like this is a person actually trying to sort of put their arms around a vast segment of human experience, cinematically. And you can tell, like, that's the thing. You watch one of these films the first time, you can tell, which is what really makes you come back to them. It was a revelation for me because while I've always liked Thief a lot, and I've written about it over the years, you know, if I had to name, we have this conversation all the time.
All the time.
Top five Michael Mann movies. It's like
when people ask people like you and me, I'm like, don't. What are you doing? I'm like, I can definitively say one and two.
Yeah.
I can say Heat is obviously my favorite, and The Insider for me is such a profound masterpiece of a movie that when I'm watching it, I forget Heat's my favorite Michael Mann film. And then I get reminded, I'm like, I think Heat's my favorite. But when I'm watching it, I'm like, this is speaking about someone getting their arms around the vastness of a human experience. I'm like, The Insider is, that person is holding on and they're not going. I don't even know how he held that into focus, much like with, you know, our guy, Alan J. Pakula, holding on to All the President's Men. How did they hold it to get it into focus for us in a film? How did they manage to get that there? But then the rest, when you're like, I don't know, on any given day, it's like The Last of the Mohicans is the best movie I've ever seen when I'm watching it. Like, and then the next day it's like Thief. I'm like, oh, look at Thief, Miami Vice, look at it all.
I watch Last of the Mohicans, and while I'm watching it, I think to myself, it's like absurd to think that there are three other Michael Mann films I think are quote unquote better than this, because it's absurd to me to think that there are three other movies at all that are better than this. You know, like how is it possible that this is the greatest movie ever made and yet maybe Michael Mann's third best film or fourth best film? Like, how does that even happen? That just makes no mathematical sense.
Yeah, it's like some kind of quantum physics we can't figure out. Neither of us are smart enough to do the math. I'm just, I can't do the math, guys. I can't explain it. I know Heat's my favorite movie of all time, and all the rest are all my other favorites. Yeah, I love all of them so much.
It's the quantum theory of Michael Mann. Every movie at the time you watch it is somehow the greatest movie ever made. It's only his second best film.
Oh, I think we just cracked it. I love when we find new stuff, new ways to tackle that.
Yeah.
But we were both watching Thief on this beautiful 4K. and Bilger, the magnificence of watching a vault burn in 4K. Oh, just everything. Like, this movie is tremendously shot. I'm just trying to think of points of differentiation for people other than obviously that big sequence. So forgetting that big sequence, just like raindrops on dials in the middle of the night when you're trying to work out alarm systems, filings of metal from drills popping up and seeing them in like absolutely pristine, the actual aspect ratio, it's a taller aspect ratio than I remembered, because it's a 1.185:1. So like, if I don't know whether it's just because of the 4K is more immersive, but in the Dolby Vision that I was watching in my home setup, I was like, the aspect ratio, it wasn't 230, like wasn't 2.35:1. I was like, oh, it's 1.85. Like, whoa, okay. Like, it looks bigger. It looks close. Like, it feels like the 4K print of Thief, if you put it on an IMAX screen, would totally work. Like, it feels like it would just work gangbusters. And then just like, they're scouting the building, the fog in LA, the textures of the clothes, just everything about it. It's already a beautifully, beautifully rendered movie. And just again, the what used to look like very homogeneous, flat, rain-soaked streets now have all these textures and contours, like people have driven over them a million times. So not only is this movie just so deeply important to both of us, but when I was watching this, I was just like, it actually made me mad in the nicest possible way of like, can you imagine just watching this in a theater with people these days? Like, what this is what movies can be, guys. This is what movies can be. And it's so personal, and it's so honest on the scale of Michael Mann, relatively small, but it is so phenomenally put together. Yeah. Just, and then particularly the pristine clarity of Robert Prosky's menacing face, which Chris Nolan completely apes in The Dark Knight, was something to behold this time around.
You're absolutely right in terms of the look of the film and also the look of this 4K. I will say I did see Thief in a theater back in 2016 when the Brooklyn Academy of Music did its Michael Mann retro, and they showed Thief. It's possible I've seen it again. There have been a multiple, you know, one of the beauties of Michael Mann's, the manassance of the past. People keep doing little Michael Mann retros. But I did see Thief in a theater. And the thing I remember, because I went to see a bunch of those films in the theater during that retro, Thief got the biggest applause at the end. Like, at the end, just like uproarious kind of applause. I mean, he wasn't there or anything, but like, it was almost like he was there. It was such a, you know, it like, it is an incredible big screen movie. Just an incredible big screen movie. The other thing, you know, what you say about sort of the textures of the film, those are really important. And you know, when I first started writing about Thief back when the first, you know, Criterion Blu-ray came out, the thing I focused on was the almost abstract quality of the imagery in the film. I mean, and I wrote a piece back then, and you know, I think it's a pretty good piece, but it's sort of about how Thief was really sort of a film that stood at the nexus of this, the gritty realism of the 70s and the more, you know, aestheticized genre films of the 80s and beyond. And, you know, one could say this is something similar about a lot of Michael's films, right? Because they have that, I mean, he joins that, like, there's this intense focus on look and color and composition and mood and attitude and the music and everything. I mean, the whole Michael Mann aesthetic, right? But then he brings this incredible sense of realism and just like incredible amount of research to the point where, I mean, the thing in Thief is like, they're using the actual tools that like, you know, that, you know, that they're consulted. They didn't build these tools. They didn't get new ones. It's like literally, he still has his tools, all company, right? And they're using them, and they're actually doing it. So there's that intense realism combined with the aestheticism, which you know was kind of new at that moment. I mean, there's a period of a few years where a number of filmmakers are trying this. I mean, They're trying variations on it. And I would argue something like Raging Bull is also in that vein, right? Because Raging Bull is an intensely aestheticized movie.
Raging Bull is one of those ones that I would say is on, like, is a peer, is a beautiful peer, which is why I've always connected Michael Mann, even though he wasn't making as many features, to that kind of new Hollywood outlook on life, because that gritty reality is there just by virtue of the fact that they're shooting lots on locations, and they're going into these spaces and creating these worlds. But for me, it's like there's something that's like too gritty and too realistic, and then there's too stylized that doesn't seem to have any substantive texture. And Michael Mann and, like, Thief and Raging Bull are like, they are right in that corridor. It is hyper stylization. It's there. It's got that style, but it is like an argument in a shitty apartment in Raging Bull is so like skin crawling, as and just like Thief. It's like all that tactile stuff they're going around, and even confrontations with Frank and guys, and oh, it's just, you feel like you're in Chicago. You feel like you're in old time New York City,
Very much so. And the other thing is that, when I think of, when I try and think of other, I mean, Michael's film is, Michael's filmography is full of, Michael Mann's filmography is full of correlations, right? And doubles. Like there's a film, you can watch a film and you'd be like, this feels like a companion piece almost to this movie, right? And, and each film almost feels like a companion piece to another, right? Because of the, I mean, his sensibility is very similar. But the movie I keep thinking about when I watch Thief is Public Enemies, right? Because in Public Enemies, he's trying to do something similarly with the textures of that movie, only now he's using video and something. I mean, I think Public Enemies is very underrated. I know it's not perfect and it's not his best, but there are still like.
Just try watching it loud in a dark room, and not go loud in a dark room, and especially in your home entertainment setup. There is it is perfectly calibrated if you have a great setup to watch that movie and enjoy it in high definition, because that's the whole aesthetic of the movie. And watch that compared to, I'll put Public Enemies against most movies I've even seen in the last 2 years. I'm like, just watch it and tell me it's not good. Like, when you're comparing it, Michael is also that, the burden is like, he did make Heat, The Insider, Last of the Mohicans, Thief. He did make those movies, yes, and Collateral and Miami Vice. And so you're watching it always in comparison to another, but I'm such a huge, huge fan of Public Enemies. Oh my God. The Chicago night, there's a night where a plane lands at an airport, and Elliot Goldenthal's score is going absolutely berserk, and they have these like tungsten bulbs that are like splaying out and carving out amongst the rain, carving out this audience of people that are awaiting on John Dillinger being moved. And I'm like, that might be one of the most exquisite shots I've seen in the last 20 years. And it's just in Public Enemies.
I mean, it's full of stuff like that. That's the thing that happened with Public Enemies, and I think, it's funny. Michael Mann. I'm sorry, I keep calling Michael like he's like
No, what's
Mann.
so funny is that I accidentally have called him Michael to our friends Katie Walsh and Travis. I said, "Oh, Michael," and Travis like, "Michael, your boyfriend, Michael Mann." I'm like, "Shut up, man. I didn't mean it. I just like it."
It just, but when you've interviewed the person, because when you talk to them, you don't say man or Mr. Man, you say Michael, right?
Michael.
That's the way it is with everybody I interview, unless they specifically say, don't call me by my first name or something.
That would be a weird way to start an interview. Don't call me by my first name. That would be, you're like, okay, this is going to be a hostile.
This
This
is
is a
all
hostile thing.
right, things are not going well. No, but the thing with Man is that, and he's never really talked about Public Enemies in this context. He's often talks about Collateral in this context, where he's like, you kind of need to see it in this particular format.
Yes.
The thing that happened with Public Enemies that I remember is, when it came out, it was still early days of high definition filmmaking, so it, for the most part, it was released on 35 millimeter, prints of the high definition cinematography, and it looked odd. Like it looked, I mean, I loved it, but it looked odd. It definitely, it didn't look, I mean, it had that video-y quality, but it had a very strange look, and it had a kind of pixelated look, if I remember correctly. when I saw it at BAM that time, at this point almost 10 years ago, it was being presented in high definition. It was, a native format, right? It had been shot in high definition. It was being presented in high definition. There had been no film in between. And I say this as I'm like a 35 millimeter purist at this point, but that film in high definition projection looks incredible.
Yeah, it does.
Incredible. And I remember after seeing it at BAM, I was just like, oh my God, this is like, I have to go and tell people this is how you have to see Public Enemies, because it looked like it was a completely different experience. And I think, watching it on Blu-ray and whatnot replicates that as well. But it, like, yeah, it kind of
Doesn't have a 4K yet.
doesn't have a 4K.
I know a couple
And
guys that who should be involved. If you're
just,
listening, if you're thinking
probably
about,
needs a, oddly enough, it probably needs a 4K more than any other of his films for that,
definitely 100%. Like straight, because the Blu-rays, I've got the Australian Blu-ray, so I'm not sure about the transfer and how good it is. Like just like I'm sure, some of the resources you can go online. You can go to like Blu-ray.com and stuff like that. And there's an entire great community around the world who like would say, oh, this is good, it's bad, it's not great. But I think that that is like straight to 4K. Don't give a new Blu-ray release with a new transfer. Just go straight to 4K. That high definition rendering, and people are going to get it. And a big shout out to Niles Schwartz. I know we've both interacted and we're friends with Niles, who has been the true champion of Public
Oh,
Enemies from the
yes.
second it came out, and I love him to pieces. And yes, if there is ever a movie and ever a guy you need to write about it, he's the guy. And
I
Bill
mean,
Guerin and I will just hang around.
honestly, yeah, seriously. No. What they should do is they should put it out on 4K and then include a copy of Niles's book.
That's what they should
Like,
do.
Niles wrote a whole book called Off the Map about
Yeah.
public, en like, literally, an entire book about Public Enemies. And, just
Why are
package
we
the two.
giving out these ideas? I'm just we just
Seriously.
write it down and we email it to someone right now. Just put the book in the packaging. There doesn't need to
Yeah.
be any essays. Then there can be like commentaries and interviews and other things. But yeah, it's a really beautiful movie. But and again, let's back to Thief. The 4K of it all, it was a revelation to me. But again, this movie, I was trying to be Bilger, and for these sort of when we're talking about physical media show, when we do our physical media shows, I really try to like tell people what's worth their money, and also like does the transfer, does it hold up, those things, the more technical aspects. I love this movie so deeply that I was sitting down taking a few notes, talking about those elements that I was seeing differences of. I'd watched like I just sort of scanned my other copy to kind of get familiar, get my eye in, so I could sort of differentiate, palate cleanse. When he starts talking, when Jesse and Frank start talking in that diner, my notes go away. The notes are gone. I'm so in love. I'm already in love, but I'm cripplingly in love with this movie. Just put down the notes and just watch it. And no wonder the audience was so rousing watching it, because I just felt like I almost wanted to stand up and clap in my office. Like my family's asleep upstairs. I was just like, this is what movies are. And it's so, and his perspective is so clear. So clear, like even from Jericho to Thief, it's so clear and crisp, it's unbelievable.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance, like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
It's such a, I mean, it's a beautiful scene, a beautifully written scene. He really has an innate understanding of how to do these long conversations. I mean, he understands, and this is, it's really true of any big scene, but it's funny because people think, oh, if the conversation is interesting, then, we can get away with it. Maybe that's true, but what he understands is a scene like this has to have its own story, right? It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And there are things happening in this scene. And he said that. I mean, how do I tell, you know, how do I do a long scene like this? And it's, you know, it was 35 millimeter film, so it was an entire reel, that scene. And, you know,
how scary would that be? Just for, you know, you worked in film, and we are connoisseurs of film. I think of the pressure of a reel that's going for that many minutes, and you're like, do we have it? Can we do it in one? Like, I just think when people beyond our age now are never going to understand that pressure, unless you're some beautiful human being like Ryan Coogler, or, you know, who is like championing those formats to like give himself all of the beautiful aesthetic pleasures, true aesthetic pleasures of filmmaking. But like the pressure of actually executing to that just feels like, whoo, got to be prepared.
Yeah, and it's because that's the other thing. The scene has to be long, right? The scene has to be long because of what's happening and what's being conveyed. If the scene is too short, then it's not going to work, right? Yeah. But at that length, you also have to keep people's attention, and not just keep our attention. Like, it's not just keep us from being bored, but like we have to lock in a way that we've never locked in before, right? And I mean, the motherfucker pulls it off, right? And he obviously wrote. I mean, it's all written, right? There's no improvisation happening there. But
even the great, like, oh, can we get some new cream?
Yeah.
What's wrong with it? It's cottage cheese. Like,
it's just cottage cheese. Yeah. What's wrong with it? It's cottage cheese. Yeah, no, but like all these little elements are there for a specific reason. Like he mentioned, you know, you kind of have to break it up a little bit and add little ping points so that, you know, there's just like some variation, because this is literally just two people talking. But also the thing that's happening is, and I didn't know, like this didn't, maybe it jumped out at me at some previous point and I forgot about it, but watching it, you know, recently, it really jumped out at me, is he's opening up obviously in a way that characters like him tend not to open up in movies. He's being very open, right? And even in the kind of vulnerability that he's showing, he's still trying to be kind of a tough guy. You know, the way he talks about what happened to him in prison, these guys, they kicked me in, I wind up in the hospital for 6 months. You know, he's just kind of like, he's like avoiding eye contact while he's talking about it. You know, he's still trying to kind of play it tough a little bit, but it's so clear that he's opening up in such a way. Meanwhile, she is showing how tough she is, right? Because she's a character who, up until, we don't know anything about her. And at this point, she's just like freaking out, you know, he's late, she's offended. We don't know anything about her. There is that great moment, though, in the car before this thing, where he's like, I'm a thief, you know, and she's like, so what? You know, like, and you're like, oh, there's something here. Like, there's more to this.
I know why he's after her. Right. I'm a thief. So what?
Yeah.
That's like the turning point of like, is she just eye candy? Is she just a cute waitress? Is she just this? He's like, no, I've been watching you.
Yeah.
You lived a life.
Right. And when they so this conversation is like what really powers it for me, or what I realized is powering it, and like subconsciously almost, is the way that she's proving in some weird way to be tougher than he is, almost, at least in that moment. And, you know, his vulnerability contrasted with her toughness, both of which are somewhat unexpected given sort of the way we conceive of such characters, really creates this wonderful tension. And that give and take, and the way that they come together really at the end, you know, there's a beautiful arc to it. And what's, you know, what I love about it is it's not just there so that we can have this big romance, right? It's really there. I mean, it's there for a variety of reasons, but what's great about it is at the end, because she agrees to be with him, and because she's been through so much, and we understand, and he understands that this is actually a sacrifice for her because she's already been through the horrors of the damned, having gone out with a criminal, right? And
A
now,
criminal working south of, working in South America selling drugs.
right? And he is also a criminal, right? Let's face it. But like he understands the sacrifice she's making by agreeing to this again. And that drives him to go and accept Leo's offer. Because up until this point, he has been a stand-up guy who's not going to fall for Leo's sweet talk. And suddenly he's just like, all right, let's do it. Let's do this, right? And we buy it. Like we totally buy it at that moment. Like even though it's a tragic decision that he makes, narratively, because we are now so invested in this relationship working that we're just like, all right, go with Leo. Like
Go with Leo, do the couple of jobs,
we can figure it out.
make millions of dollars, then get out of there, and then go and live a happy life. Go and make your collage come true.
And this is, I mean, this is the challenge of all genre narratives, right? Because there's so many predictable elements in these things. There have to be, right? You can't really
We're
completely.
comforted by the predictability, so it's okay.
You can't completely confound our predict our anticipation because then we'll be really upset. But like, how do you take something that is, in its broad strokes, familiar? Right? We know, like, as soon as Leo shows up, we're like, oh, this is fucked. Like, we're so fucked. He's so everybody's fucked, right? But it's not like, oh gosh, we're just sitting around waiting for something horrible to happen because we get so invested in what's happening that we're like, ah, maybe they can make it work. It's like, it's funny, a movie that has nothing to do with Thief in any way, shape, or form. But like I have a similar experience watching Anora, right? Like Anora is a movie where it's like, I mean, opening scene of that movie, you're like, well, nothing good is going to happen to anybody in this movie, right? I mean, to 2 minutes into that movie, I'm like, ah, every single character in this movie is completely fucked, And sure enough, that's basically what happens. I mean, every narrative development in that film, if you just outlined it on a piece of paper, you'd be like, well, of course, this is what's going to happen. So how do we make it fresh? How do we involve the audience so that you're with them? Like you're just like when he proposes marriage to her, as crazy as it is, and as delusional as it is, and as doomed as it is, and we know all this stuff, how do you make that moment like, oh, maybe they can pull it off this
Maybe
time?
they can. Maybe they could go against all odds. Maybe she can get out of this situation.
Right. So much of filmmaking is really it's Charlie Brown and Lucy with the football. Right? I mean, every movie is basically that, right? Certainly every genre movie, it's like, well, she's got to pull the football away. Like, I don't know, you guys have Charlie Brown in
We do
Australia,
have
but
Charlie Brown.
really
It's
familiar, right?
just
But it's
holding the
like,
ball. You're holding the ball, waiting for him to kick it. And as soon as he goes to kick, you just move it away and he falls on his ass. Like, it's
right.
just
It's
that
going to
you,
happen
it's
every
going to
time.
happen.
And every time he thinks he's going to pull it off this time, and it never happens. And really, so much of filmmaking, especially genre filmmaking, is just Charlie Brown and Lucy with the football. And how do we make the audience think this time Charlie Brown's going to kick the football? And of course, he never kicks the fucking football.
It's the Wile E. Coyote of it all. We
Yeah.
want him to catch Roadrunner so much, but it is also much funnier when he blows up or falls off a cliff or runs through a truck or, runs into a painting. It's
And
this.
it would be so disturbing if he did catch the Roadrunner. Imagine like finally, I mean, I'm sure somebody's working on it now since everything is public domain now, but a film that ends with like, the Roadrunner actually like, or the coyote actually roasting the Roadrunner on a stick
Just
and eating it. Like,
chewing his legs like a turkey leg at Thanksgiving or
it would be
something like that.
traumatized.
Very bad.
I wanted to add something else. This is another thing I noticed, in a recent review. In a recent rewatch, and again, it's a thing that I'm like, well, how the hell did I miss this? And so it's entirely possible I noticed it at some other time. But I mean, obviously, we know that the film is about, the exploitation of labor, right? I mean, it's very broadly and very obviously about that to the point where there's, lines of dialogue about it. But it never quite registered to me how much those kind of long passages of these guys working and stuff like that, It's really, I mean, when you watch it, it's beautiful, and it's like, oh my God, here's 5 minutes of, people just like sawing open a saw, and the sparks are going everywhere, and it's gorgeous. But really, what he's also doing is showing you, this is work. Like, this is exhausting work. And that scene where, after they've broken into the safe, and you see Frank just sit there and pull out a cigarette and just relax. I mean, it's great.
I had our friend Brianna Ashby. I asked her to do a sketch for me of
Yeah.
James Caan's face. I've got it.
Yeah.
It's on our website. Of James Caan's face in that scene. Because
Yeah.
that scene is everything to me. That pause of like he's covered in soot and grossness and he's got the satisfaction of hard work. And he
Yeah.
enjoys the work.
Right. That's the thing. It's like, I always read that scene, and I don't think this is wrong, but I always read that scene as almost this like triumphant moment, right?
Yes.
Which it is. Which is, it's like, we did it. He's been trying all movie long to like build something to help him, to allow him to break into this thing. And he's finally done it, and he's relaxed, and it's triumphant. But what I never quite caught until a more recent reviewing is also just the sense of just like utter like exhaustion
Yeah.
on his face, and just relief. And like, that's so important, because it allows us to viscerally feel the amount of work and labor that has gone into this, so that when he is exploited by Leo, it's not just, oh, Leo screwed him over and Leo sucks and we want Frank to get ahead because he's in love with the woman and he's, we like Frank. It's really, man, he just worked so fucking hard
He
to
works
open that
so,
fucking
yeah.
safe.
No one could have done it. He's
Yeah.
putting himself in huge peril. He's literally melting something that's falling apart. They're putting down fire retardant things. They're holding this stuff. It's almost impossible to operate, and they're there doing it. And he takes that protective eye mask headwear off, and he's beaming with sweat, and he's covered in soot. And you imagine the whole room is toxic, noxious chemical smell.
So he
And he
lights a
did.
cigarette.
So he lights a cigarette. You know what? I would too. I would
I
too.
know, right?
I would too. Just give me one. Oh, thank God. What a day. But yeah, it's Frank likes the work. Frank
Yeah.
wants to work. He wants to be productive. There's this weird thing of like, I want to work. I want to work. I want to look after my family. And particularly the stakes of the work. Yeah, it's not like he's just, gone and mowed someone's lawn and they've screwed him over. It's like, no, I risked my life. I chopped through walls. I risked being arrested. I risked all this. I had this built, and yeah, it's a magnificent scene. And then you can see when he realizes the error of his ways, what he has to do to shut this down, what he has to do
Yeah.
to undo it.
There's a thing that a couple of things that we talked about in our interview that I didn't include in the finished piece, just because it's a long interview and there were things, you just at some point you have to kill your darlings. There were a couple of things we talked about that weren't included in the finished piece, but I wanted to highlight a couple of them. This is what I mean when I say that, man, really, there's a personal element to all sorts of things, even just the way he thinks about certain things. So we talked about the political and ideological aspects of Thief, right? And I asked him, and this part, I think one part of this is in
One
the
part of
interview.
it is in the view. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he's talking about how, in Europe, the people really understood that it's about the labor theory of value. And then he said, but I cut this part, but this is a reference that he's made before, right? He's made it with in even interviews I did with him. But he said, the conceit I had about the themes of Thief was that you could take this entire motion picture and you could transport it into an advertising agency in Chicago, like Leo Burnett, and tell the same story about an artist who goes to work, a writer who goes to work as a copywriter, if you like. He sells his labor in this sense, or an artist who becomes a layout designer at Leo Burnett. The story would have had the same construction. And he's specifically made that Leo Burnett reference before. And I asked him, I said, you've used this Leo Burnett comparison before, and I've always wanted to ask you, were you that copywriter, or were you that artist? Were you the guy at the advertising agency? Because I always thought to myself, he must have like lived through this, that he's constantly making this Leo Burnett, like specifically Leo Burnett comparison. And he said, no. At various times, I directed some commercials, and so I had some contact with them. And he said, I had a very good friend named Paul Rode, who was a copywriter at Leo Burnett. He was from Chicago, went to Princeton, was a very talented writer, and became a copywriter at Leo Burnett. He died young. Now, I don't know anything about this guy, Paul Rode. In fact, one of the reasons I didn't include it was like, I don't even know if I have the right spelling of the guy's name. Did some searches, obituaries, stuff, couldn't find anybody. That doesn't mean anything. It just means he didn't die recently. And he specifically said he died young. But I was just like, oh, how interesting. Like, this is a guy that he knew who worked there. And I can't help but think that, man's interactions with him maybe spoke to this guy's own frustrations. Again, I don't know. I didn't pursue this line of thinking or, and, it was getting to the end of the interview. But that's an interesting thing, the fact that that has always stuck with him. And the idea of like the frustrated artist or the frustrated writer who's kind of stuck in this world and is being exploited, or is doing something that no one else can do, really. And it's being used towards this kind of very sort of specific material end, and he can't break out of that. And in the case of this guy, I don't know when he died, but he said he died young. So, maybe he dies before he's able to accomplish his dreams. And the idea that that must have stuck with Michael Mann all these years, that
All
it
these
comes
years,
up as
that's
this reference point, you know?
and I've even heard Leo Burnett in your interviews with him, that and that whole thing. That's
That's
it's
touching,
fascinating.
right? Very,
It's
very interesting.
he's a really beautiful artist because it's like he was just touched by a peer at a period in his life, and they've resonated in his work of like that exploitation, that being trapped, that not enough time. It's right there. It's right
That's
there.
the thing about man is that he I've interviewed him a bunch of times, and we've had a couple of meals within the context of either interviews or events and things like that. I don't hang out with the guy, so I don't know him as a person. He's always been very nice to me. But the thing is, I get the sense when he interacts with people, especially when he's doing research and things like that, he's obviously absorbing a lot of information. This is the thing people often say about certain filmmakers, and they used to say this about Kubrick. It's like when you're talking to him, he's just like absorbing all this information from you. He's not telling you about how he's doing, but he just wants to know everything, because he's like, very often, obviously, these are people talking to him in the context of research, and it's like he's just like
He's a sponge.
sucking data out of you, right? But a lot of it is emotional data, right? It's not just here's how I would do this, right? Because that's the thing. He also, I think he did say this in the interview, but he was talking about, the research he did with like thieves, and he wanted to get a sense of sort of their emotional lives and what their ordinary lives are like. So it's not just how would you go about breaking into this safe, or how would you go about, or with cops, like how would you go about, investigating this crime scene, right? Because he gets that information too. But there's also this other thing he's asking, which is, how do you feel about this? Like, how does this affect your life? How does this affect what you bring home to your family emotionally? How does this affect how you proceed in life? And that's something that, I mean, these existential questions, this question he always says his characters are asking, or he imagines them having asked before the events of any film, is that at some point they always ask themselves, who will I be in this world, right? I mean, that's the great existential question. And it's a very mid-century question, right? I mean, man is, born in the 40s, but he does some definitely has this kind of like this mid-century, almost
Yeah,
Hemingway,
he's
Steinbeck kind of
yeah.
like Fitzgerald, like the he's clearly influenced by the arts and literature of that period. This kind of like often men, but obviously it's true of anybody. I mean, I think it's true of, it's true of Tuesday Weld's character. And at some point you ask yourself, what's going to happen to me? Like, who am I going to be, and how can I get there? It's just that's the thing that really strikes me about man, is that he doesn't just want the procedural data of how a person goes about their business for his work, but he really wants to know like how what this does to their brains and
And
their
what it does to
mind.
every segment of their private lives. It's like, you look at Frank. Frank's a beautiful orchestration of it, which is like he goes out to his first job. They then dump their work cars at a undisclosed location. He then goes and performs his handover of these wholesale goods, and then goes and performs as a car dealer salesman. And he's there. And then when something personal comes in, that's one of my other most beautiful touches. When that letter comes from Okla, he steps out of the office. He's like, I almost have to get out of this facade. It's not me. It's only just here. This is a front, literal and figurative, to his true pursuits. And he gets out of there. And it's him reading this letter away from that space and then back and moving and through the world. And it's like, and that choice to go. With Robert Prosky's character Leah, like that choice there in that moment is okay. Well, I want to try and get out of this life. I want to try and collapse the facades. I don't want fronts. I don't want to have these structures that protect me so that I can do my work that I really enjoy. It's, I just want to collapse everything. And yeah, he's got such a command of it, which is why, when I first studied him and first really loved him, I was just like, he's got such a, he, that new Hollywood worldview that guides a lot of like socio-cultural, economic, political perspectives is a guy that came out of that period in that kind of post-World War II, burgeoning existential time. It just is riddled through his work. And that's not a bad thing. It's just like, it just shows that he's a man who exists in this world. Like, who will I be in this world? And who he navigates himself as through the world is that him answering that question and through his characters and through his storytelling. But it's something that riddles his characters, which is so nice that he's like, I'm not above this, and my characters aren't above it, and I'm not telling stories that are too distant away from my human experience. In a lot of ways, he's trying to connect with other, just the universality of it.
I love that you mentioned Okla and Willie Nelson's character because that's another thing that struck me recently, with Leo, because obviously the story turns on Frank initially rejecting Leo and then kind of agreeing to kind of be part of the outfit and then rejecting him again. And Leo even says, I don't remember the exact line, but like, at some point Leo actually like lashes out at Frank because he's just like, no, you're different, huh? Like you don't like every, everyone. He doesn't say this specifically, but you get the sense like nobody else tells Leo, no, I'm not going to do it. Everyone else is eager to just get in on it, right? And Leo's like, you're different. Why are you different? And the other thing is like if you look at the way Prosky plays him, and obviously the character is conceived, he's so soft and avuncular at first. I mean, we can tell initially, immediately, we're like, well, there's
As
something's
soon
off.
as you see the way that other people are interacting with him, the way that they are reacting to his presence, you're like, that fucking guy's trouble. He's trouble.
But he does put out this front of being very, very soft-spoken and kind and paternal, right?
Yeah. I'd be your father. He even says it. I'd be your father.
He says, I'll be your father. And the thing I realized is the reason why Frank rejects him, and the reason why Frank has kind of the moral fortitude to reject him, is because Frank has a father and Okla is his other father. Like the fact that Okla is there is almost like this talisman, this lucky talisman that because he was fortunate enough to have connected with this guy in prison, he has a kind of a moral gravity that allows him to reject Leo's because someone else in his position probably wouldn't, right? I mean, you're a guy who's just gone through the tortures of the damned in prison, you're out, you're pulling scores, and a guy like Leo comes and puts his arm around you and is like, listen, my son, you and I, we're gonna figure this out, and I'm gonna give you everything you want. You're like, oh my God,
Great.
this is
Thank you.
perfect.
Thank
Thank you. What did I do to deserve this? And it's like, you didn't do anything, you're gonna get fucked. But
You're going to do exactly what I say for the rest of your natural life, and then if you don't do what I say, I'll kill you. Is
right,
the
exactly.
implicit
And
thing I believe.
because Frank had the good fortune of interacting with Okla and still connecting, you know, still having this connection to Okla, you realize, oh, he has a father figure, you
Yeah.
know? And I think that's really important. I think it's, you know, I mean, we know he was state raised, right? He didn't have a father. But Okla became his father, and as a result, Okla kind of has this gives him this gravity, because that's the other thing. Is like Okla is, you know, I mean, Okla has like two scenes, right? Literally the scene in prison, and then he comes out and he dies. And there's
And that scene in prison is just.
oh, beautiful. Another great, you know, comment, not as long, but this is like so. He's, you know that great meme, you know, time at the club, impact at the club. Like Okla, it's like time at the club, impact
Impact
at
of
the
the
club,
club.
right? Like Okla shows up. I mean, all told, his scenes add up to what, 7 minutes? I don't know. I haven't timed it, but it's just kind of like,
Not even probably.
but the man like hovers over this entire movie.
So good. I don't think we could end better than time at the club, impact at the club, thinking about Okla and Thief. We've done the quantum physics of Michael Mann. We've talked about his existential, this existential vein that works through his work. And then we've talked about Willie Nelson, time at club, impact at club in Thief. Bill Gabbiri, you're the best. I love talking about Michael Mann. We've got more Michael Mann to talk about a little bit later in the year. But thank you so much for doing this. And thanks for your beautiful interview. I'm so glad that you got to do it, because I read it and I was like, you know, it's one of those things whenever a Bilger article drops, particularly the friend groups start sharing. But that morning, because of when it posted Australian time, I had like 15 DMs, people going like, oh, new
Oh.
Bilger just dropped. New Bilger just dropped Thief, man. And I was like, guys, if you think I don't read Bilger, if you don't think I've already got notifications to see what he's been up to, you're really wrong, because you're just the best. And look, folks, Thief must upgrade, must get it. It's absolutely a stunning movie. It's just one of those ones that doesn't matter what format it is. If the next one is the brain implant chip, I'm buying it. Get it. It's available at Criterion. You can get it. There's lots of beautiful sales. If you've already got a copy and you want to wait a little while, keep an eye out on it. But always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend. It's so good. So good to talk to you.
Likewise, thank you.